Change is happening faster than ever, and it's never been more important to know what's next. At Hogan Lovells, we're talking every day with clients and colleagues to conquer the most significant issues we face, and our What's Next podcast brings that dialogue straight to you. In this episode, Logan Breed, a partner with Hogan Lovells Antitrust Practice, sits down with Daniela Combi, Vice President and Assistant General Counsel at IBM. They'll talk about the explosion of data, the emergence of AI and cognitive computing, and the evolving relationship between in-house and outside counsel.
Thanks, Daniela, for coming in and speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
IBM is always at the cutting edge of technological advances. From where you sit inside the company, what are the areas of current and potential innovation in the future that IBM is most excited about right now?
There's so much going on at IBM. You know, IBM has such a deep history of technical innovation. You think we've been around for over 100 years. And just this last year, we achieved 25 years of patent leadership. We invest 7 to 8% of our revenue every year in our R&D. And so we have a deep, deep history of innovation. About 50 years ago or so, we launched something what we call the programmable era of computing. And you think about the mainframe, right, that runs so many institutions came out with something that IBM worked on and developed in the 60s, still being used by so many companies, of course, transformed over time. We consider that to have been a seismic shift, you know, in the 60s. I think we're really at another one of these inflection points today. And it really revolves around the explosion of data plus computation. And by computation, I mean not only the raw processing power. You know, you think about just the processing power in your phone today versus even the mainframes of the 60s. I mean, it's just incredible. So the raw processing power, but also the availability of processing power through cloud computing. So now you have incredible volumes of data, incredible access to computation. And now what can you derive? You can try to derive really deep insights that you couldn't derive before. So it's a really, really exciting time for something that we've called cognitive computing, others call, and we've now sort of decided to call as well, artificial intelligence. And you can just see this enormous power to see patterns and solve problems that could never be solved before.
Well, Daniela, is AI unlocking an ability for us to use data that wasn't really searchable or accessible before?
You know, it's interesting because one of the powers of our artificial intelligence is it doesn't just work with structured data. It works with lots of unstructured data. And so today, about 80% of data is just simply not searchable. It's not searchable because it's not in a structured form, and it's not searchable because it actually belongs to companies and enterprises that it's their data set. And so it's really a great era for kind of the incumbent companies, right, to leverage all of this incredible information they have. So what's unstructured data? I mean, you're talking about email, you're talking about videos, audios like podcasts, for example, and all of these other sources of data that now you have a capability to actually glean insights from. So businesses are really embracing AI, you know, in every part of their operations, from the back office to the front office, for the simple reason, I think, that they understand that the ultimate competitive advantage that it gives them to outrun their competitors.
So, Daniela, have we maximized the value of AI at this point, or is there still more runway for this technology to improve?
So, you know, we've had all of these various laws in computing. You know, Moore's Law is one that those who are in the microelectronics space will certainly understand. Today, I think we've kind of named something called Watson's Law, where you say the exponential data plus AI produces exponential learning. And so I think if we sum it up, I mean, boy, AI has us really excited. And not just for, you know, what I'll call the sort of the toys. I mean, we all use kind of AI toys in some ways, right? In the social media sense of the ability to just tag a photograph, right? This is a dog, this is a cat, this is your mother, whatever it is, right? That's a form of AI. But what we're working on is stuff that I think really matters in the world. Healthcare, thinking about doctors having better access to cancer treatment options utilizing AI, cybersecurity, regulatory compliance, and then things like improving customer experience and customer service, just to name a few. And a lot of this is very complicated. And when you work on really interesting, complex things, you typically don't do it alone. you leverage a variety of strategic partnerships and relationships that help you push that envelope as well. Some of those are for us today are, you know, whether Salesforce or Workday, New Relic, Verizon, others. And so to really realize the benefits of innovation, you definitely have to be in a world where you're collaborating.
Are there other examples of technological innovation that IBM's working on today that have some game-changing potential?
Yeah, of course. You know, there's so many, but I think blockchain is one of them. Obviously, a lot of publicity around blockchain, and I'm sure most everybody who's be listening to this podcast would have heard about it. So what is blockchain? It's really a shared ledger for recording the history of a transaction. A ledger, and what makes it so powerful, that no single participant can alter. So blockchain really is the technology that underlies things like Bitcoin, virtual currencies. But really what IBM is working on is using blockchain for other types of transactions. You think about every transaction, for example, something as simple as ordering something online. You've got to place the order. You got to somebody has to catch that order at the other end, ship the goods. There has to be a payment made. And today, those things are all tracked in individual systems, disconnected from one another. And really, every participant in that transaction has their own version of the truth, right? And, you know, if the two of us were transacting, I would have to trust you and you would have to trust me, right?
Right.
At some point, there could potentially be a dispute. Well, what blockchain actually helps cut down on those disputes because there's only one version of the truth. You think about the prospect of reducing errors, fraud, inefficiencies, and again, disputes. And where does the term block come from? Well, think about every single step in a transaction being digitized, and then those digital blocks being connected together into a chain. The data is sound, it's verified, it's easily tracked. Pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. can you give us an example, Daniela, of how blockchain technology has been deployed in practice to accomplish some of these things you're talking about?
Sure. I think a really interesting example, because I think it touches so many people, is around the area of food safety. It's not maybe a natural one that you think about from a blockchain technology perspective.
Right.
All right. 600 million in the world fall ill after eating contaminated food every year. 420,000 of those people die from those illnesses. In the U.S. alone, the total cost from foodborne illness is more than $55 billion per year. And a lot of that is the loss of, obviously, lives, which is always terrible, and illness. But it's really that economic productivity from inability to work and also food waste and medical costs, right? I mean, if you don't know where something came from and you know it could be contaminated, guess what? You're going to throw out everything, right?
Sure.
And today, without blockchain, it could take weeks to accurately identify the source of contamination because it's such a complicated food supply chain, all the way from the farm to the shelf in the grocery store, local little market, right? And it's the delays in pinpointing the source that really inhibit timely containment of illness. So because of blockchain, we can provide consumers, farmers, carriers, retailers, and regulators this greater transparency by digitizing the existing food safety process and product information. And you're creating a single historical record, you know, that is then easily searched, improving tracking and tracing capabilities and enabling pinpoint precision of the source. We, in fact, partnered with Walmart on a couple of trials, one where we track pork in China and another one, mangoes in Mexico. And using a blockchain-contained digitized food safety process versus not using it, right? So not using it probably takes about a week to trace something back. Using blockchain took about 2.2 seconds.
Wow.
pretty incredible,
right?
That is
incredible.
Much more work remains to be done, but what's really exciting is we have a lot of early adopters, you know, not just Walmart, you know, Kroger's, Dole, Driscoll, Unilever, and others, because they are so excited about the potential of what this can do to really make a difference in their own businesses and in the world.
So IBM is saving lives and money by using blockchain to track Chinese pork and Mexican mangoes. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So Daniela, I know another cutting-edge technology that IBM is leading on is quantum computing, which frankly sounds like something out of a sci-fi movie to me. But what exactly is quantum computing? Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, it does sound like that, doesn't it? A little bit to me as well, since I'm not a scientist by background. So I'll try to explain it in a way that I understand it. it really is an important area of innovation. And look, we're in the very early days of quantum computing, but it has potential to radically alter how we process information. So quantum mechanics is a branch of physics that explores how the physical world works at the most fundamental levels, where particles behave in strange ways, taking on, and this is a really important thing, taking on more than one state at the same time. If you think about conventional or classical computers, they use transistors. They only have two states, on and off, ones and zeros. So the fact that you can leverage these quantum phenomena into a computer, right, is what's so exciting about quantum computing, because it allows you to solve complex problems that are just impossible to solve today. For example, consider a caffeine molecule in a cup of coffee. Surprisingly, that's so complex that no computer today exists that could actually model caffeine and the full understanding of its detailed structure and properties.
We just know it's awesome.
That's exactly. Agree 100%. So this type of challenge, quantum has the potential to really tackle. And you can untangle really complex molecular and chemical interactions, which you can lead you to discover new medicines and materials, just in sort of that scientific realm, in the financial realm, to model financial data, isolate key global risk factors, and obviously adding power to artificial intelligence and the like. And IBM has a sophisticated commercial quantum processor that forms a core of the first early access of quantum for commercial customers. And in collaboration with key industry partners, IBM is significantly increasing computational capability of future quantum systems. And of course, we're demonstrating that this can be real.
So who is IBM partnering with there? What steps is IBM taking here in the quantum space?
Great. So we've established something called the Q Network. It's a worldwide community of leading Fortune 500 companies, their startups, their academic institutions, some of the national research labs. And they get to access the quantum computer that's sitting in New York in our lab in Yorktown. And most of us are never going to have a quantum computer anywhere near us because they have to operate near absolute zero in terms of temperature. So it's quite cold, but you can give access. And we have key members who've joined the IBM Q network, including Daimler and Samsung and JP Morgan and JSR, just to name a few. And they're playing around with applications in their industry. So Daimler is working with us on how quantum can improve transportation. JP Morgan Chase on looking at the potential for quantum in finance, such as in trading strategies and risk analysis. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, we're actually giving access and working with commercial customers on fundamental research still in this area so that we can really propel this into the market much faster.
So it sounds like quantum computing has amazing potential. Are there any downsides or potential concerns from unleashing this powerful technology on the world?
So what's interesting is that quantum computing could break current encryption methods. And it's something that we're very focused on. I mean, when you think about the power of quantum, of a system like this, you can understand why if you can compute much faster, that you can break most 128-bit, 500, whatever it is, those encryption methodologies. And because we have foreseen that possibility, we're developing post-quantum encryption methods. And in fact, we've submitted some of our proposals to the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. We call this method lattice cryptography, and we believe that no computer can crack it, not even future quantum computers.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I'm sure there are a lot of others out there who are working on similar ways to continue to protect data from being stolen or hacked. I think IBM takes very, very seriously its responsibilities to bring new technologies into the world in a responsible way. And this is just one example of that. You have to be really good stewards of the future.
You mentioned submitting post-quantum encryption methods to NIST. It seems that with all of these rapid technological developments, it may be that your business is outpacing regulation generally, particularly on a global scale. How does that affect your role as an IBM in-house lawyer?
You know, that's a great question. I've been at IBM quite a number of years, and I think about years ago, I think regulatory compliance and the areas we had to worry about, both from the standpoint of geographically and scope, was a much narrower space. Maybe you were looking at environmental regulation, export, import, maybe antitrust. I think now in this new world that it's just so much more complicated. I mean, you think about AI. Well, what does AI depend on, right? Data, flows of data. Well, data flow across borders, right? So how do you deal with what's required from a regulatory perspective, like let's say a cybersecurity perspective, privacy perspective, in every jurisdiction that the data is now crossing into and across borders? And it's just the complexity of that is just amazing. So how do we stay on top of it? I think we leverage a lot of capabilities. Part of it is the colleagues we have around the world. IBM, we're very fortunate. We're a multinational company, and we're fortunate to have lawyers in many parts of the globe. You certainly stay on top of the regulatory changes through leveraging sister organizations, whether it's our government relations team that's staying abreast of developments in various countries. Customers, you often learn from your customers because there are new demands on their businesses, industry groups, and of course, regulators as well. So you create a network, kind of a spider web of information. And an important relationship, I should say, more than a source, is our internal clients. They're pushing the envelope in a lot of these innovative spaces. And to really be side by side with them, understand where their business is going and try to stay ahead of it in terms of the regulatory advice that you can provide. And really, hopefully, impacting their direction ultimately, you know, so that what they're building is more in line with where the regulatory landscape seems to be going as well.
Sure. So not to be too selfish about it, but do you see these developments as changing your relationship with outside counsel, places like Hogan Lovells, in light of these disruptions?
So changing in part, but I think really leveraging in part. Again, there's such complexity in this world. I think we rely on outside counsel as well to help us navigate the mazes of laws and regulations. And especially when you're in one field, you're not an expert in everything else, right? So the fact is that those relationships to really consult with outside counsel, that's very important. So I'm sure that that will continue to be the case. I just look at one area, you know, as we've been all staying abreast, we talked about blockchain earlier. I mean, you just look at the whole issue around initial coin offerings and cryptocurrencies, which we're still very interested in, right? I mean, the laws are developing constantly. I mean, every country, every jurisdiction here in the U.S., every state is trying to figure out what to do with this stuff.
Right.
So how do you stay on top of that if you want to be in a space that touches anything like that?
Right. Well, and does that mean that your relationships with regulators are evolving as well? I mean, how do you deal with that?
They know what they know, and it's for us to educate them on the things that they don't know and where this technology is. And, you know, you just look at going back to AI for a moment, you listen to some out there and they're talking about science fiction, right? True science fiction. The robots are going to take over the world.
Right.
You know, they're these sentient beings that are being created. That's science fiction. And we need to talk to regulators about what's going on today, what we see happening over the near-term horizon, and make sure that they're not stifling innovation by over-regulating for things that really are just science fiction.
Yeah. So as you're rolling into these new areas, what new issues come up for you at IBM? How do these new technologies create issues for you?
Well, interesting. I mean, of course, with emerging technologies, there are certainly new issues. I mean, if you, again, look at AI, and especially AI that's trying to do really meaningful things, like in healthcare and financial services, and where you're trying to solve real-world problems, fundamentally, people have to trust these systems. And it's, to me, no different than, you know, bringing in any new technology, you know, throughout the ages, right? You have to trust that your GPS is going to send you to the right place. You have to trust that when you step on a brake, the car is going to stop. Pilots have to trust navigation systems and airplanes. And so, you know, you have to bring in these things into the world and give people confidence that they could trust these things. And how do you do that, right? You have to really think through how you go about that. Some of it is transparency and explainability. Some of it is the level of testing. You have to look at the data. What data set is being used to train these systems? Is it trusted? the work we've done on Watson for Oncology, for example. It matters who trains these systems. It matters what data you're using. So I think you build greater trust, right, when you think about it from its inception as to how you go about it. The other thing is that our view is that there's a person there, right? There's a person, there's a professional who's taking the output of these systems and putting their judgment on it. So in the healthcare space, a doctor, in the legal space, a lawyer, financial space, a financial analyst, whoever it is, our view, again, and this is IBM's view, because we're fundamentally focused on the enterprise kind of companies, is that you're always going to have somebody who's also putting some judgment on. The other, I think, really interesting thing, and I would be remiss if I didn't talk about it, is the whole issue around bias, right? And ethics, right? You know, how these systems are going to be making these judgments. How do you know that they're not going to be biased in really important areas, like giving loans to people or,
right,
for example, making decisions around incarceration and the like. And again, I think it's so important that there be transparency as to how these systems work, explainability, again, that you're really looking at that data set and making sure that the data set itself is not biased.
Sure.
And going through that data set to kind of clear out the bias. And then again, who's making that ultimate decision? But these are important discussions to have that we at IBM are not having just ourselves and among ourselves, but with others in the industry as well.
So how is IBM responding to those concerns? How is IBM building trust and finding ways to deal with some of the problems that could arise in the use of artificial intelligence?
Yeah. So one element is that really in our research team, they are focused on trying to figure out how to use AI to actually minimize bias, right? And to actually use the capabilities to, you know, your technical capabilities to deal with the problem. And then the other thing is, as I said, is to work with others in the industry, with academia and competitors and thought leaders around these issues so that we're thinking about them in a broad way. I think the other thing, and this is what's really important, I think I mentioned earlier, you know, IBM believes in bringing in new technologies into the world in a responsible way and thinking about the downside. And we've certainly thought about that in the context of AI. In fact, last year, we introduced IBM's principles regarding data and AI responsibility. And they spell out, I think, really clearly our point of view around the globe. And I think they are grounded in some of the values that IBM has. So we're going to lead in data responsibility and ethics and transparency and that explainability. We also need to think about the workforce, right? So we want to make sure that the workforce is prepared for dealing with these new technologies and leveraging these new technologies and have great programs in place to do that, both for our own workforce and the retraining, as well as training the workforce of the future. We really continue our company's century-long commitment to diversity and inclusion. I mean, the more diverse a data set you have, the more likely you're going to minimize bias. It's so grounded in who we are. I mean, I go back to, you know, one of our values, our fundamental IBM values, is that innovation, that we're focused on innovation that matters, but not just to our company, but to the world. And so when you come back to your what you stand for, then these things are not quite as challenging.
We've talked, Daniela, about how IBM is innovating and deploying new technologies to help the world be a better place. How is it helping you? Does your legal team get to take advantage of any of this stuff to make your job easier?
Absolutely. And we actually have lots of efforts going on to do even more, but I'll just name a couple. Our legal team has played a key role in developing an analytics solution that helps address potential corruption risk in distributor and reseller transactions and vendor purchases and employee expense claims. That's been rolled out. We're also exploring how to use some of the cognitive solutions within the law department through intelligent query systems for contracts and cognitive self-help capabilities for our internal business clients so that the legal team can spend more time focusing on some of the bigger issues. Recently, we've been working on a new offering in our financial services unit and our Watson team around Watson regulatory compliance. And this is something certainly of value to law departments everywhere, but our view is it's of value to us as well. And it kind of also helps address that challenge we talked about earlier around staying abreast of the laws. And this would really be a tool that streamlines the identification of potential regulatory obligations, reduces the time and cost of compliance, enables sustainable management of controls. In short, you know, Watson is ingesting all of the relevant laws in a particular field and then alerts the lawyers and paralegals and or people responsible for compliance, right, of what's changing and how best to operationalize it. So really exciting, some very exciting capabilities.
Well, that does sound actually really exciting, but also for me personally, maybe a little scary as a lawyer who's got some kids at home that are going to be going to college soon. is it the case that Watson and other AI solutions will eventually replace all the lawyers?
No, not at all. I think I've kind of alluded to this earlier. Our view is that really these AI solutions augment human expertise, both bringing in much more breadth in terms of the materials you can cover and gain insights from, and maybe glean new insights from, right, that you wouldn't otherwise uncover yourself. And so they're not meant to replace lawyers or doctors or anybody else in the field. But again, I think anytime you bring in new kinds of automation of any sort, you're going to have some jobs that go away. And so those people whose jobs may be displaced, I think we have a responsibility to think about how do they get trained to use these new capabilities. So for lawyers in particular, I think it allows us to have the time to work on the more complex matters, to spend the time with clients advising them. And I don't see it as being a replacement for the lawyers.
That's encouraging for me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Daniela, we've got listeners tuning in from across a wide range of industries, and many, if not all of them, have been or will be impacted by artificial intelligence, the other technologies we've discussed. Mm-hmm. What lessons has IBM learned that would help in-house counsel across the board in other mm-hmm. industries as well?
Yeah. I think really work closely with your internal clients and understand their business plans, understand the technical aspects of what's going on, kind of what how they see the world, where it's going, so you can stay on top of these regulatory changes as well. Enable your customers to deal with the laws that and regulations that impact their businesses. I think you're going to have incredible value there. Engage with colleagues, your sister functions, and you know, to your businesses, external organizations. To just see where the law is shifting and stay current on the law. Obviously, we talked a little bit about regulators, and I think educating the regulators is a really important aspect of what we can do as in-house lawyers working with our government relations teams and the like. I think overall, when it comes to AI or any technologies, be a lifelong learner. Embrace it. The worst you could do, I mean, the fact is that AI is with us. And so now you have to figure out how to turn it into something that is valuable to you. I think one overall thing is just a general aspect of being a lawyer in-house, or especially in-house, I would say, but maybe for outside lawyers too, is you know, recognize what you know, recognize what you don't know, ask for help. We don't do any of this alone. So whether it's help from your outside counsel or help from others in your own business or outside of your business, industry associations and the like, and learn, keep learning.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, Daniela, for your willingness to come in and speak with us about IBM and its technology and the issues that you face. IBM literally is the most innovative company in the history of the world, and it's always fun to talk with you about your business. And we look forward to seeing what IBM comes up with next.
This was wonderful. Thank you, Logan. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
For more information on this topic, or to learn how we're helping other clients solve their toughest problems, visit HoganLovells.com. Music for this podcast was created by Jazzar. Check out their library at BetterWithMusic.com.